It's 7:30 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Beth Voorhees. The mystery surrounding the Esau script issued to women in coal camps. A sociologist believes the stories.
Blair Mountain was about the union card, but it was also about settling the scores and solving the Esau problem and the way the script was administered, the entire social system and the cultural system that was imposed on the miners.
But a coal historian does not. The debate coming up on this West Virginia morning. The economic outlook for West Virginia's Eastern Panhandle over the next 5 years looks good, according to West Virginia University's Bureau of Business and Economic Research. Cecilia Mason reports.
West Virginia has added about 3,000 jobs since the middle of last year, according to this year's Bureau of Business and Economic Research Outlook report. Director John Deskins presented the outlook for the Eastern Panhandle to a ballroom full of business leaders from Berkeley, Jefferson, and Morgan counties gathered at the Martinsburg Holiday Inn, beginning with a look at the statewide forecast.
We're predicting about 1% growth going forward in the state for the next 5 years. That's a little bit slower than what we project for the nation as a whole, though. We predict about 1.6% growth in the nation going forward, about 1% growth annually in the state.
Deskin says the three Eastern Panhandle counties have rebounded from the recent recession. The area lost about 3,500 jobs during that recession, but has gained nearly 4,300 in the past 3 years.
But the Eastern Panhandle has been growing at a strong pace, and the performance of the Eastern Panhandle economy has been by far one of the strongest parts of the overall West Virginia economy. We have this part of the state has really been driving economic growth for the state as a whole. In many ways, the economy looks so good here, and we expect that strong growth to continue. We expect the Eastern Panhandle to be one of the leaders for West Virginia as a whole.
And Deskin says the unemployment rate is also moving in the right direction. The report says unemployment in the Eastern Panhandle was 8.3% in 2009. It was down to 5.4% by the end of 2013, the lowest since 2008.
That improvement in the unemployment rate isn't at all because of labor force attrition. That improvement that we're seeing and that we're forecasting in unemployment is entirely because of job creation. It's not because of people leaving the labor force. I mean, indeed, the number of people in the labor force here in the Eastern Panhandle has actually increased by more than 2,000 people over the last few years. That's a good positive.
One leading source of jobs is construction. The report says the single-family home market is rebounding, and construction projects like the Macy's Distribution Center and a new high school in Berkeley County have bolstered the numbers. It predicts the construction sector will grow 9% a year over the next 5 years. The report also forecasts a 3-4% a year increase in high-paying jobs in the professional, business services, and information sectors. It predicts a slowdown in growth in the areas of government jobs and says competition from gambling in adjacent states could impact the leisure and hospitality industries. The report also offers some observations about the demographics in the three counties. Deskin says overall the population is younger than in the state as a whole.
I mean, here in the Eastern Panhandle, the median age is 39.4 years versus 41.7 for the state as a whole. About 2 years on average, people are younger here in the Eastern Panhandle compared to West Virginia as a whole. That's good news for the economy going forward, and the people here in the Eastern Panhandle tend to have higher levels of educational attainment as well. More good news for the Eastern Panhandle.
The report predicts the population in the Eastern Panhandle will continue to grow over the next 5 years at a rate of nearly 2% a year. However, the state overall is expected to see a population decrease during that time. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Cecilia Mason in Martinsburg.
A judge has given the State Division of Juvenile Services and a Charleston-based public interest law firm more time to finalize an agreement. That document will set standards for the division to follow in terms of the due process rights of residents, as well as the education, nutrition, and recreation afforded to them. As Ashton Mara reports, the year-long litigation is winding down as changes are being implemented in facilities across the state.
Judge Omar Abulhassan heard what may be the last evidence in the case filed by Mountain State Justice against the Division of Juvenile Services.
The conditions you're in are substantially better than they were at Jones, are they not?
They are.
B.M., identified only by his initials for the court, is a juvenile resident of the Sam Perdue Juvenile Center in Princeton. He is one of the 25 residents relocated after Abulhassan ordered the closure of the Harriet B. Jones Treatment Center in Salem over the summer.
What was that list show that was provided for dinner that night?
Meatloaf, mashed potatoes, cream beans.
What was actually provided?
BM testified the Perdue facility follows their meal schedules about 60% of the time, serving pepperoni rolls, chips, and prepackaged cakes for dinner when their cook is off or on sick leave.
The detailed description of the incident, we were locked down from 12:30 to 2 o'clock p.m. During this time, officers refused to tell us why we were locked down or answer the intercom.
S.Y. is an 18-year-old resident of the Donald R. Coon Juvenile Center in Boone County and has been in the custody of DJS for over a year. S.Y. testified to support a grievance he filed when the residents of his wing were locked in their rooms for almost 2 hours. He says the residents were told it was a punishment for an individual's behavior in the cafeteria.
Roughly how many exercise machines do you have? About seven. And how many of those are in working condition? Three to actually turn on.
LB is a 19-year-old resident of the Northern Regional Detention Center in Wheeling, where she says their indoor rec room has only 3 or 4 working exercise machines, and she currently has no access to additional vocational training because she has already received her high school diploma. The center only has high school and GED classes. These residents were all called on to testify on behalf of Mountain State about the quality of life for juveniles in the custody of DJS. Their issues became concerns not just of the public interest group, but also of the state, as the two are working on the details of an agreement due to Abulhassan in 2 weeks. The Department of Military Affairs and Public Safety released a draft that starts with new policies. These policies are to ensure residents have due process rights when they file grievances and have disciplinary hearings. Stephanie Bond is the acting director of DJS.
Previously, as I said, we were using the notice of charges form. We felt strongly that met what was in the court order because it gave a brief summary or description of the charges. Mr. Hedges and Ms. Milnes disagreed with that.
Dan Hedges and Lydia Milnes serve as counsel for Mountain State. Bond says DJS will now give residents a full copy of the incident reports at least 24 hours prior to their hearing. Hearing officers will be required to give residents a written decision afterward. Also, as part of the agreement, DJS is seeking 5 new employees in their central office in Charleston who will travel the state to hold these disciplinary hearings.
What we have been doing is trying to find a person that is a non-direct care staff to do the hearings to keep it as fair as possible. And in our smaller facilities, that's almost impossible because everybody has contact with the kids. Therefore, we have a maintenance worker. But nonetheless, we are going to make these separate positions. They will rove between facilities.
The team will not be tied to any one facility with the goal of providing an unbiased handling of complaints. As for the concerns brought forward by residents in the hearing, nutritionally, Bond says facility meals are certified by the Office of Child Nutrition in the State Department of Education and meet national guidelines. She says lockdowns occur only during necessary times to ensure the safety and security of residents, but happen far less often than a year ago. But the educational opportunities for female residents are a more difficult task to approach. Bond says she is working closely with the Department of Education, who provides the academic and vocational training at all state facilities. The department has completed the process of converting 2 rooms into classrooms at Northern. They are also taking applications for and hiring teachers to provide business administration classes for residents with diplomas or GEDs. Similar classes are in the works for other facilities in the state as well. Abulhassan has asked counsel to begin working on their final reports reviewing the changes DJS has made over the past year and where they need to go in the future. He says this includes continuing to work with the court monitor or hiring an internal monitor to observe the 10 state juvenile facilities. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Ashton Mara in Charleston.
This is West Virginia Morning. It's 7:40. Rain likely today. Temperatures in the 50s and 60s. Isolated rain overnight with lows in the 40s and 50s. Mostly cloudy Thursday and windy with a chance of rain Thursday afternoon. Temperatures remaining in the 50s and 60s tomorrow.
Support provided by the West Virginia Hospital Association. The new health insurance marketplace provides a variety of choices, coverage options, and enrollment information available at healthcare.gov or 1-800-318-2596.
Now we return to the second of a three-part story about the haunted history of the Whipple Company store in Fayette County. The store was built at the turn of the 20th century as West Virginia coal miners began agitating to bring the union to the southern coal fields and is now operated as a museum of coal camp life. Producer Catherine Moore visited the store with several locals for a story on the paranormal activity reported there, but got a lot more than she bargained for, in addition to the usual ghost tales. We heard yesterday the story of the Esau scrip issued to women specifically, with their very bodies as collateral on the loan. But as we'll hear, not everyone is so sure that these stories add up to history. Here's part two of The Soul of a Company Store.
We head up to the store's vast third-floor ballroom, which company officials and mine guards treated as a clubhouse of sorts. We peer into a small wing off the main room, which Joy Lynn, the store's owner and its star tour guide, refers to as the shoe room.
It originally started out as the smoking room or the waiting room for the gentlemen, but we've had multitudes of women come in and tell us, as little girls, they can remember their mothers coming to the company store. And one of the things that a lot of the more lovely ladies had to do was come upstairs. Some of the young girls had the stories shared by their mothers, stating that they would be escorted into the shoe room. There would be a selected guard who would be waiting for them, and they would receive a brand new pair of shoes with no accountability to that other than to perform whatever service the guard wished to have in lieu of pay. We had one woman in particular share with us that her mother was a young girl about 25 years old and bought her first pair of shoes here. And the woman's entire life, those shoes remain in a shoebox on her closet shelf, never to be worn, and she refused to wear another pair of shoes the entire life. She made her shoes out of cardboard, newspapers, and twine.
Now, let's just stop right there. The Esau story and the story of the shoe room suggest an institutionalized practice of forced sexual servitude that was a part of company policy. If the abuse happened that way, it changes radically our understanding of coal camp culture. And not everyone's jumping to conclusions.
It is disturbing to myself and those who came before me from that area to think that the females of our family could have been forced into that situation without us reacting.
That's Dr. Paul Rakes. He was born in Scarborough near the Whipple Company store, where he drew his first payday from the New River Company. After working 20 years underground as a coal miner, he earned a PhD in history and is now a professor at WVU Tech. He primarily studies coal mine disasters, but more recently he's been looking at life in the coal camps, particularly violence as it occurred there.
Miners would not tolerate violations of their concept of what was fair treatment. They were not chattel slaves. They were what TAMS called a hard-bitten lot. Very independent in spirit, quick to take offense. If they are politically and economically disabled to some extent, They are not culturally and socially disabled. That's the difference. Those men I know from years of research, family unit and unit of friends, would have done one of two things. They would have either left that camp as soon as they knew this kind of behavior was required or a potential danger, or they would have reacted to it violently.
Don't look now, but it did come out in a violent way.
And that's Wes Harris, whose background is in sociology and labor organizing.
Okay, Blair Mountain was about the union card, but it was also about settling the scores and solving the Esau problem and the way the script was administered, the entire social system and the cultural system that was imposed on the miners. If you think Blair Mountain was just about a union card, well, you're sure giving these guys a lot of credit for loving the union, and I love my union, but not that much.
And it is true that some of the battles that unfolded during the mine wars are still shrouded in mystery. We have to acknowledge the unexplained uprisings that are still unaccounted for, and that perhaps the miners were exercising their agency in ways we don't yet understand. Still, Rakes has pored through stacks of criminal court proceedings in Fayette County and says he's never come across anything like the Esau story. And as a historian, that's troubling.
I would require some significant documentation. If this kind of behavior was common, was actually institutionalized, part of the operating procedure, you could not keep all these things quiet. Some highly self-reliant coal miner would have killed someone over it. It would have ended up in Fayette County Court.
I say it's laughable.
Wes Harris.
The culture was you do not talk.
Wes travels to fairs and festivals around the state, where he sells his book about the Battle of Blair Mountain. He says the story of Esau Scripp has come to him unprompted.
Usually it's in terms of grandpa told me or my grandmother had to take the Esau. That's a phraseology, had to take the Esau. A gal that I, you know, agreed not to name, but she sat across the table from me and said, you know, I can tell you this stuff was real because my grandmother had to take the Esau, but my mother doesn't even know. And so that's how tightly held it was. One gentleman said, yeah, I heard about Esau from my grandfather. That was kind of like the cousin every family had and nobody wants to talk about.
Could it be that roughly 100 years later, Esau is becoming public? If so, it's likely too late to document firsthand accounts. Joy says she has documents that substantiate the Esau and Shoeroom stories, a letter and a list of women's names, but won't release them because she says she fears for their privacy. It's been difficult to get any kind of documentation from Joy. The only thing that's a fact, she maddeningly tells me over and over, is that the building exists. I've talked to other historians about it, and most equivocate. There may be validity to the claims, they say, but they need evidence. For Dr. Rakes, what we can see and what we do know is tragedy enough.
What history has shown us that cannot be challenged is that the reality of the loss of civil rights, constitutional rights in coal camps, economic restrictions that coal miners live under, that's a tragedy. And it was a tragedy for my grandfather, who ended up with a broken back in coal mining and lived in poverty the rest of his life. And I'm not taking anything away from that. By the same token, I'm not applying that to these other social standards.
But Wes says that part of a historian's job is to go out and look for the evidence when something as potentially important as this surfaces.
The historians of the previous eras didn't do their homework, didn't ask the right questions, so we don't have the records that we would like to have. Doesn't mean it didn't happen. It means we didn't do our job well, and that includes me.
Tune in tomorrow morning as we further unravel the haunted history of Whipple Company Store. For now, I'm Catherine Moore, reporting from Whipple, West Virginia.
West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Keep up with all the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Find stories, photos, and videos, and you can subscribe to our West Virginia Morning podcast. We're interested in your comments. You can send them to feedback at wvpublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at wvpublicnews and find us on Facebook. Support for our our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our producer is Ben Aduccio. Our director is Bob Powell. I'm Beth Voorhees.